Hello and welcome to the One World Science Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Liebarger, and today's topic is one of my favorite things in the known universe. Spider monkeys. In 1937, the now famous Mexican artist Frida Kahlo completed a painting titled Fulong Chong Iyo, a portrait of herself with her favorite pet spider monkey. It has been said to recall Renaissance paintings of the Madonna and Child, reflecting an exalted connection between herself and this non-human primate. Many have interpreted her spider monkeys as real-life surrogates for the children that she and her husband Diego Rivera could not produce. Setting aside modern, yet very important, criticisms of owning monkeys as pets, it does seem that in this painting, Frida intentionally blurred a long-held distinction between humans and other primates, and in doing so, expanded the sacred space of personhood by placing Fulong Chong in this hallowed position. In fact, she did several paintings with her spider monkeys, each revealing a deep connection with these evocative primates. The idea of non-human persons has been in the news a lot over the past few years. In Argentina in 2014, the courts recognized an orangutan's basic rights as a person, not a thing. While here in the US, the Non-Human Rights Project has fought to establish a form of legal personhood on behalf of four chimpanzee clients. They have argued that these great apes have a fundamental right to liberty, protected by the writ of habeas corpus. While spider monkeys are not apes, or even catarrhines, the taxonomic category containing old world monkeys and apes, including humans, it is nonetheless rather easy to see in them what Frida Kahlo must have experienced. I've recently worked with a group of spider monkeys myself for 6 months, but it doesn't take nearly that much time to get a sense of their individual personalities. Such a statement only a few years ago would have drawn jeering responses, and likely still does, from hardline scientists afraid to anthropomorphize any creature that isn't human. This is certainly tricky territory to navigate. However, in recent years, the tide has turned somewhat, where research has seemingly vindicated the erstwhile champions of non-human individuality, including Jane Goodall. Her work in Gombe National Park in the late 50s, early 60s had attributed unique personalities to the chimpanzees that she studied, and I see similar characteristics in the spider monkeys that I've worked with. This is not the only similarity between chimps and spider monkeys either, but we'll get into that later. First, I'd like to introduce you to a spider monkey whom I know quite well. That is Ramona. She lives at the Machia Wildlife Sanctuary in Bolivia, operated by Comunidad Intihuarayasi. She is a species known as Ateles chimec. Ateles is actually the genus, and it means incomplete or imperfect. However, if you ever meet Ramona, you would not feel that there is anything incomplete about this strong, elegant monkey. Despite having been rescued from the illegal wildlife trade, she carries herself through the jungle with the slow, confident grace of rainforest royalty. It was the famed French naturalist Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire who long ago named the genus, which contains 7 species of spider monkey, as well as 7 subspecies. He even has a species of spider monkey named after himself, along with a cat, a bat, and a tamarin. Who could not envy such a legacy? As for spider monkeys, he apparently thought of them as deficient because of their reduced or absent 5th digits on their forelimbs. In other words, because their hook-like hands had evolved to lose their thumbs. The thing is, if you ever see a spider monkey rocketing through the rainforest canopy, the first thing you notice is just how little that missing thumb really matters. They swing, dash, and bound with an acrobatic grace that seems almost preternatural. I have personally watched Leo, a young male in Ramona's makeshift group, jump from the upper canopy and fall at least 7 meters before casually hooking a lower branch with his arms, then keep swinging along like it was no big deal. Some scientists think that thumbs might have actually gotten in the way as these monkeys jungle gymmed through the trees at breakneck speeds, rivaled in this regard only by their distant gibbon relatives on the other side of the world. Gibbons are apes best known for how rapidly they brachiate or swing beneath the branches, rather than walk upon them like most monkey species do. Incidentally, gibbons also have no tails, as is true for all of us incomplete apes. When we look at the gibbon's hands, they are elongated and hook-like in a similar fashion as the spider monkey's hands, but they have retained an opposable thumb. However, that thumb has migrated far from the other fingers, supporting the idea that it may have gotten in the way during brachiation. Besides spider monkeys, only the very closely related Murrikes of Brazil and the highly arboreal Colobus monkeys in Africa share this trait of reduced thumbs, likely for similar reasons of locomotion beneath the branches. But the thumb thing isn't the only interesting adaptation of spider monkeys. Their long, lanky arms for suspensory locomotion are also quite striking, as are their specialized shoulder girdles. But the real show is their super long, prehensile tails. These tails can be longer than their bodies and function very much as extra limbs with tactile pads, like fingerprints, to grip branches and to hang hands-free while feeding voraciously on fruits. In fact, when they hang like this from the branches high in the trees, you can kind of see how they might resemble spiders, albeit very strange-looking, hairy, giant, fruit-guzzling arachnids. In order to get a grip on where spider monkeys live and how they interact with their environment, I decided that I needed to speak with an expert.
Okay, yeah. So I'm Andres Link. I am a private behavioral ecologist.
I had found the right person. Andres Link has studied spider monkey social behavior, their role in the ecology of tropical forests, and the conservation of these endangered primates for 20 years.
Yes, so spider monkeys are relatively large-bodied primates. At least they're one of the largest that live in Central and South America nowadays. And they have a diet that relies heavily on ripe and mature fruits. So they're considered to be ripe fruit specialists. And if you look at most of the studies that have been done on them, approximately from 70 to 90% of their diet is composed of ripe fruits. Because of that, and their large body size, they depend on large areas to be able to take the amount of energy that they need for their daily life.
Because spider monkeys have large home ranges to utilize sometimes hundreds of types of fruits dispersed throughout their territories, they are more sensitive to habitat degradation and loss due to human activities.
Although they can live in fragmented landscapes, generally they're quite dependent on forests that have minor or no anthropogenic disturbances. So they're monkeys that are mostly found in pristine habitats that have the availability of fruits that they depend on.
When fruit becomes scarce, spider monkeys will often supplement their diet with leaves. In other words, they become more folivorous.
Yes, even the earliest studies found that in places, for example, that were undisturbed, in the periods of the year that fruit availability was lower, monkeys would switch to a more folivorous diet, would eat a larger proportion of young leaves and other items. And it's interesting because what we find in fragmented landscapes is that the pattern holds, given or what we expect that in these places there's a lower availability of fruits, even year-round. What you find is that these monkeys have to rely more heavily on leaves.
For a monkey that's quite dependent anatomically on ripe fruit, Andres explains that switching to a leafier diet could have implications for their health, since the switch to eating leaves for longer periods of time seems to be happening more often as their habitats are disturbed. Spider monkeys, with their very fast gut passage rates, may struggle to extract nutrition and energy from the lower quality foliage. I was also curious about how this dietary change might relate to geophagy, which is the eating of soils. I had seen the species of spider monkey that I had worked with in Bolivia eat mud on many occasions, and Andres had been involved with research looking into this with another species of spider monkey in Colombia. I asked him if monkeys might eat soil to help with the digestion of different compounds found in leaves.
Yes, that's a hypothesis that we have. What is known is that there's a larger component of secondary metabolites and other toxins or things that are difficult to digest in leaves. And thus, a folivorous diet would require to be able to eliminate or mediate some way these toxins. But also, the other part that is important is that in order to extract the energy from leaves, most animals rely on bacteria that are able to help on fermentation processes. And you need, the food has to be a long period in your digestive system in order to be able to do that fermentation. So for monkeys that have very fast passage rates, probably a folivorous diet doesn't allow them to extract all the nutrition, the different elements from the leaves. So it has those two components.
Interestingly, Andres tells me that not all of the New World monkeys eat soil. Howler monkeys and spider monkeys in western Amazonia and near the Andes appear to do it the most.
But whenever they can do it, it becomes a very common behavior. They'll do it once a week on average and will be coming very frequently to eat soil, which we think might be helping to deal with these processes of toxins and also to get some additional nutrients. The whole behavior that they have associated to going to the mineral leaks, these places in the ground where they eat soil, is also very, very nice because they display a very, very stringent behavior trying to increase the chances of detecting predators. So they can last 2 to 3 to 4 hours looking for predators in the areas where they go down. And the whole process is like a ritual, just to go down for a minute or two to get some soil from the ground.
However, what is truly remarkable about spider monkey appetites is what happens when they don't have to resort to leaves and soil or any other alternative food option. As they devour their preferred healthy diet of ripe fruit, which they consume rapidly in large gulping quantities, they benefit the tropical forests where they live by being important seed dispersers.
Yeah, tree species find mechanisms to disperse their seeds. A large amount of them, at least in tropical forests, do it through animals, and especially animals that eat fruits that have something to attract them, a nutritious or sugary pulp. And others do it by wind, by water, by structures that help them get away from their parental trees. If you look at spider monkeys, it's pretty interesting because they have a very broad diet. Spider monkeys in some areas in Amazonia might eat from more than 200 or 300 tree species. But what is interesting is that they will share some species with other frugivores, with birds and bats.
Andres explains that some tree species, such as fig trees, are generalists, and their fruits are eaten by many different animals. But for other trees, spider monkeys are likely one of the only seed dispersers.
For example, there's many trees from the family Sapotaceae that have a very strong husk, so it's difficult to break into the pulp, and they're very large. So spider monkeys and probably only a handful of animals are able to eat these fruits and disperse the seeds.
So spider monkeys disperse seeds for hundreds of tree species, but are especially important for dozens among them who mainly rely on these primates for their dispersal. These hungry frugivores, frugivore being the scientific term for animals that specialize in eating fruits, swallow hundreds of thousands of seeds every year, some up to 30 millimeters in diameter. Very few other fruit-eating animals will be large enough to swallow seeds that size. These seeds go in whole and undamaged, and they come out again, intact and with fresh fertilizer. A fair amount of this pooping occurs at the trees where they sleep and defecate throughout the night, so those seeds end up relatively clumped together in the same area.
But the fact that they have very broad ranges does make them take the seeds to lots of different areas. They disperse most of the seeds in transit, while they're walking, while they're moving through the trees. That does increase the chances of seeds falling in a place, for example, where there has been a recent tree fall or where the conditions are suitable for germination. So I think the fact that they use large ranges is positive for the recruitment of new seedlings.
This is an important factor in generating the famous biodiversity of tree species in tropical forests. But to fully understand why seed dispersal is crucial, we need to consider something known as the Janssen-Connell hypothesis.
Janzen Connell.
The Janzen-Connell hypothesis hinges on the idea that seedlings are less likely to survive near their parent trees. This may sound strange, because we are used to thinking of parents as increasing the survival prospects for their young. Indeed, that is certainly true for spider monkeys, whose young are carried by their mothers into their second year, and who may not be weaned sometimes until over 3 years old. The situation for trees in tropical forests, however, is quite different.
What the Janzen-Connell hypothesis proposes is that there's a density-dependent effect on the germination of these seeds that are dispersed.
A seedling trying to grow under the crown of a parent tree not only may struggle for sunlight, but there will also be insects, pathogens, and other predators that specialize in feeding on this type of tree. Such predators are more likely to exist close to the parent tree, which is their host, and they are also more likely to be found where there are many trees of the same species growing very close to one another. This means that the best way for young and vulnerable seedlings to survive is to travel as far away from their parents as possible. As Andres mentioned earlier, this is done in a variety of ways, whether they are scattered by the wind, carried on the water, or transported by animals attracted to their fruit. Even though you'll find fewer and fewer seeds as you travel from a parent tree, the lucky ones that have gotten further away will have a better chance of recruiting into the next generation. In many cases, you have a win-win mutualistic relationship between trees and those animals who consume their fruits and disperse their seeds. The ultimate result is a more diverse landscape, since whenever one tree species begins to dominate, it will attract more predators. These predators in turn prevent that tree's fragile seedlings from thriving close by, and in this way, opportunities will arise for different tree species to grow there.
And spider monkeys obviously will be playing a major role in taking those seeds to places that are far away from their parental trees.
And so you might wonder, what happens when spider monkeys disappear from tropical forests?
Recent studies that have been made at the community level in Amazonia, at least, have shown two things. The first one is that spider monkeys are some of the first vertebrates or large vertebrates that disappear in fragmentation processes, like in smaller fragments. But also, when they have studied or compared places with large frugivores as the spider monkeys versus those that don't have them, they have noticed that the carbon sequestration, I mean like the density of the wood of those areas where spider monkeys have been extirpated, are lower. Meaning or saying that probably many of the hardwoods, many of the species that are able to sequestrate large proportions of carbon dioxide are not present in those forests.
Because spider monkey populations are so sensitive to fragmented or degraded landscapes, they are often considered indicator species, whose status reflects the overall health of an ecosystem. The habitat loss and fragmentation happening throughout their range is a particular problem for these primates, who require large territories containing diverse forests with high fruit availability throughout the year.
I would say that in South America, the major drivers of the transformation of lowland forests, that is where you most often find spider monkeys, places like the Chocó or the Amazon forest, are due to the transformation of forests, sometimes to crops, but generally to cattle ranching. Cattle ranching is one of the major drivers of land transformation in South America. Although quite like recently, I mean, the last few decades have seen a large increase of monocultures, palm oil, soy. A lot of these large monocultures have also used a lot of the forest that was remaining for agricultural production. So those two drivers of land use change are prevalent, I would say, in all South America.
Spider monkeys are also traditionally hunted because they are large and can provide a fair amount of protein.
Hunting is also very stringent on spider monkey populations because they have very slow life cycles. They reproduce when they start reproducing when they're 7 or 8 years old. They only have one offspring every 3 years. So any hunting pressure has a major effect on their populations. You can imagine that in order to preserve the spider monkey populations in the wild, you need, of course, to protect the habitat. That's like an important prerequisite. But you also have to have a reduction or no hunting in the areas because their populations are very sensitive to these kinds of pressures.
Due to the decreasing populations of spider monkeys throughout the Americas, it is urgent to find ways to help them survive.
So there are different types of conservation initiatives. Some are related to the establishment of protected areas of different sorts, natural parks or private protected areas. But recently, there has been many initiatives that have tried to get local stakeholders involved in conservation. So, for example, in Colombia, there's a very nice project where large cattle ranchers have decided to protect and conserve the remaining forests and are willing to create connectivity corridors between them, also enforcing no hunting in their areas. And that allows these populations to reconnect and not be in isolated patches that has also problems associated with them, but are also a way to kind of integrate the economic development of certain regions, especially those that have been already transformed, with the conservation of the diversity that is in there, and for this particular case of the populations of spider monkeys that are so vulnerable to those changes.
Interestingly, one notable way that their forest habitat has remained most intact is through land management by indigenous peoples in their ancestral territories.
I have been lucky enough to work with several indigenous organizations over the last 20 years.
That is Rob Wallace. He is a zoologist and senior conservationist at the Wildlife Conservation Society, where he is the director of the Greater Madidi Tambopata Landscape Conservation Program. He works in a region of northwestern Bolivia and southeastern Peru that covers more than 40,000 square kilometers and has an altitudinal range of nearly 6,000 meters.
If you look at the Amazon, over the last 15 years, indigenous territories actually have less deforestation, slightly less deforestation than protected areas. And of course, both of those management units have much, much, much less deforestation than areas outside protected areas and indigenous territories. But what that shows is the effectiveness and the commitment of indigenous peoples across the Amazon in terms of conserving forest cover and generally looking to protect biodiversity into the future.
Recently, Rob and his team have worked with various indigenous groups to develop materials that demonstrate the value of indigenous territorial management. They split this value into three broad categories: economic, environmental, and sociocultural.
Intrinsically, from a sociocultural perspective, the implicit value of each indigenous culture is, of course, extraordinary. But also, you can look at the economic value in terms of the way they are committed to sustainable use of a whole suite of different natural resources and how those projects contribute to the local economy and the regional economy, but also the environmental value in terms of, on the one hand, protecting forest cover, but on the other hand, also making major commitments to protecting ecosystem services like, for example, watershed protection. There are a whole suite of ways in which indigenous territories are extremely interesting and important, and for the future of the Amazon will be crucial, given that at least a quarter of the Amazon is made up of indigenous territories.
Another important consideration when seeking to conserve species and habitats is for scientists working in the field to share what they learn with the general public. This can build interest, knowledge, and even a sense of pride and stewardship. Rob recently took part in an ambitious expedition called Identidad Madidi, which sought to catalog and share the biodiversity of Madidi National Park in Bolivia. Many people do not yet realize that this park hosts the greatest number of species of any protected area on the planet.
Identidad Madidi was born out of a recognition of the importance of communicating the exceptional status that Madidi National Park has to the Bolivian public, primarily to an international audience too, but primarily to the Bolivian public.
In Bolivia, as in nations everywhere, the population is growing ever more urban. As this occurs, there is the risk of disconnection from natural landscapes and, by extension, from the importance of conservation.
We live in an increasingly urban world. Latin America is actually the world's most urbanized region. So at the moment, I think across Latin America as a whole, it's around 80% of the population is considered urban. In Bolivia, it's a little bit different. I think it's 70% at the moment, but the trend is the same.
Rob's work with the Wildlife Conservation Society focuses on developing what they call a local constituency for conservation. In doing so, for the last two decades, they have primarily worked with local communities, indigenous organizations, municipalities, and the staff of protected areas. But with Identidad Medidi, they are deliberately reaching out to also include an urban constituency, which will support protected areas, indigenous communities, and general conservation efforts. Rob tells me that there wasn't sufficient information available to most Bolivians about the extraordinary diversity and beauty of their country's natural heritage, so they set out to begin addressing this. Their scientific team visited 15 sites across the many elevations and habitats inside Medidi National Park. They collected data and shared photos and videos with the Bolivian public, and all of the scientists involved were Bolivian as well, apart from Rob, who has lived there, by his own accounting, for 25 to 30 years. They finished up their fieldwork in November 2017.
The team is now working on the reports and also beginning to pull together scientific manuscripts about the findings. And what we've established is that Medidi is indeed the protected area with the most species of birds and butterflies and plants and mammals. And for the moment, it's in second place for amphibians and reptiles.
It should perhaps come as no surprise that the symbol of Medidi National Park, this hotbed of biodiversity with no shortage of charismatic creatures to choose from, is the spider monkey. These are alarm calls from a group of spider monkeys that I worked with in a different part of Bolivia. I usually had no idea what would occasionally set them off like this, but certainly spider monkeys do have predators, ranging from harpy and crested eagles to jaguars and pumas. The adult monkeys are more difficult for these predators to catch because of their size, savvy, and speed, but it's still a jungle out there, so vigilance and communication are important. They are also thought to communicate vocally as a way of coordinating their foraging activities and to maintain social cohesion.
They use vocalizations to communicate between the subgroups and basically are probably communicating about fruit abundance and are able to respond to that and basically travel, relatively long distances during the day to ensure a high energetic intake.
Throughout their days, spider monkeys make a range of vocalizations, from barks to whinnies and much in between. They're especially noisy when they play. Whinnies have several functions, but are often thought of as individual identifiers. At first, I was taken aback when personally greeted with one. You'd be forgiven for thinking that the monkeys are taunting you as they vocalize. They have a comical facial expression that goes along with the greeting. Their lips are scrunched forward and their faces are often frowning. However, I came to regard such an acknowledgement from group members as high praise indeed. I was apparently worth speaking to.
Hola, Ramona.
Spider monkeys also communicate through various olfactory signals, in other words, scent. However, this is mostly related to mating, and they are not widely believed to be marking their territory. Most curious to me is their sternal glands. They might use their hands to rub saliva or a leaf and saliva mixture onto this area of their own chests. I used to watch Octavio, a remarkable male spider monkey who had been raised as a pet, then rescued, as he intensely smushed handfuls of parsley against his chest. Since spider monkeys often greet one another with embraces and sniffing of the sternal gland area, this may have been how he concocted his signature cologne. Perhaps one of the most interesting things about spider monkeys, though, is their social structure. To begin with, although sex ratios vary, almost always there are more females than males.
It's a society where males remain in their natal groups, and females are the ones, the sex that disperses.
In other words, once they are old enough, the females typically are the ones who leave home to go seek their fortunes with a new group. Again, Andres Link.
And this makes males to be more closely related to each other than females, so they're like patrilineal societies.
Furthermore, relations within these groups do not appear to be very hierarchical.
For the studies that we have conducted for 12 or more years, we have not been able to detect hierarchic relations between males or females. And that makes it even more interesting because it's easier to explain how these societies, these males that are related but also share in a relatively even way the paternity and the reproduction, also have very, very tolerant relations. And probably, this is just a hypothesis, it might help them in having very strong bonds to support themselves in fighting or competition with other groups that are their real rivals.
Without strict dominance hierarchies, sexual behavior is promiscuous, characterized by what are called consortships, where the mating couple quietly leaves the group to copulate in private.
Spider monkey reproduction is quite unique. Copulations are extremely long. I would say probably some of the longest among primates, if not the longest, which you would imagine that if the purpose of reproduction is only to fertilize ovules, it shouldn't last that long. But there has to be something social or maybe something about bonding or paternity or something in these kind of copulations that can last 20 minutes or so.
Due to the quiet and private nature of their consorts and just the general difficulty of studying spider monkeys in the field, these copulatory events are quite special when observed in the wild. My friend Thythelia Coro witnessed just such an event when she was a research assistant working in Venezuela.
It's really difficult to see them in the wild because they hide from the rest of the group and also they don't make any kind of vocalization. So it was really difficult to see them up in the branches, you know, in the trees. The male was on top of the female, putting his feet on her legs, and they last for around 10 minutes. For me, it was really impressive because they were doing really softly movements. At the end, they joined the rest of the troop and they started running really fast and vocalizing. And I always find a place in any conversation to tell this story and how slow and passionate they made.
Although spider monkeys are not very sexually dimorphic, one obvious feature of the female is a very large, prominent, and pendulous clitoris. They are so conspicuous and distinctive that often researchers can use them to help identify individual monkeys, and I certainly did when working with the group at the Machia Wildlife Sanctuary. I asked Andres what he thought the reasons might be for such an elongated clitoris.
It is really, at least for me, it's still puzzling. I don't know if it has something to do with pleasure or something related in sexual activity, if it has something to do with keeping some kind of pheromones. But to be honest, I would say that we know very little about it, even though it's a very conspicuous characteristic of these primates.
As for the male reproductive organ, they're one of the very few primates who share an unusual characteristic with humans, the complete lack of a baculum, aka penile bone. Given their lengthy, single-mount copulations, you might have expected it would be useful. Males within groups also show more affiliative behaviors between each other than females, and are the more gregarious sex. They bond more tightly with each other. This could be due to them being more closely related, as Andres mentioned earlier, and because they need to cooperate to patrol territorial boundaries, defending against neighboring groups.
They converge in a lot of behaviors with other species like chimpanzees, one of our closest relatives, and some small-scale human societies like hunter-gatherers, where males that are closely related will cooperate to defend their territories and sometimes to fight to other groups of neighbors, of male neighbors.
You could predict the number of males in a group based on the boundary length of the territory.
That was Rob Wallace. He explains that while spider monkey communities studied to date have had sex ratios favoring less males and more females, the large group that he studied was atypical, having an equal sex ratio of adult monkeys. he discovered that this was related to the unique geography of his study site.
Because the longer the territory boundary, the more males you need to defend it successfully.
That is actually just spider monkeys at play, not real aggression. After working with them for some time, you come to love that sound so much. To me, one of the most interesting behavioral parallels between spider monkeys and chimpanzees is the fact that they both have what are called fission fusion societies. This means that the larger group frequently splits into smaller subgroups throughout the day, constantly shuffling their members into different social combinations.
Very, very rarely, in fact, do you see all members of a spider monkey community or a group together. Because what spider monkeys do is form fluid subgroups that can change several times during the day, the membership of those subgroups and the size of those subgroups. And what they're doing is basically responding to the different patterns of ripe fruit distribution and overall availability in the forest. So in the wet season, usually ripe fruits are relatively abundant and are also often ubiquitously distributed across a spider monkey range. And so you will see relatively large spider monkey subgroups in the forest responding to that overall ripe fruit abundance. But during the dry season, you know, normally the dry season, ripe fruits become more scarce and more concentrated. And so in many cases, the groups will be smaller. And indeed, during the season where ripe fruit is incredibly scarce, you often get very, very small subgroups that don't tend to move as much and membership doesn't tend to change as much. So that's really what's driving the social structure of spider monkeys.
Probably fission fusion societies, at least in primates, have emerged in primates that are relatively large in body size and that depend on a frugivorous diet. And probably this is because females that are large and depend on fruits that are distributed unevenly but patchily in the forest tend to have a dispersed society. They cannot defend their resources. They don't need other allies to defend them. So they are kind of dispersed in space. This prevents a single male from being able to monopolize many females because they're dispersed in very large areas. But a group of males can defend, in fact, a territory where those females are within, let's say. And probably the nature of being large and having to reduce competition by splitting has created or has found in the fission fusion dynamics, has found an optimal solution. You can be with more monkeys when there's less competition, or maybe where there's more predation or more risk of predation, but you can also split apart and not compete so directly when there's less food or when you don't need to be worried about predators. So there's some conditions that we think that might have increased the chances of fission fusion dynamics to emerge.
Many believe that the cognitive demands of this type of social structure could be a factor driving the spider monkey's larger brain size.
What some people have proposed is that given that social relations are so important for primates, this might have been one of the drivers of the evolution of cognitive abilities. And what I would speculate that for monkeys that are not all the time together, being able to know how your relation is with each member of the group, but also how it is with other members that are not all the time under your surveillance, becomes a challenge. And maybe that and other things might have driven the pattern that is true, that is that those primates with high degree of fission-fusion dynamics do have a larger brain than you would expect given their body size per se.
When I spoke to Rob Wallace about this, he agreed and contrasted spider monkey societies with the social structure of another neotropical primate, the similar sized but folivorous howler monkey.
I don't want to diss howler monkeys here because I love them, but it's much less complex.
He explained to me that howler monkey groups typically include maybe 5 to 10 or 15 individuals, whereas spider monkeys have communities of between 20 and 50 or 60 individuals. These communities are never all together at once because they are constantly broken up into various subgroups. Their size is adapted in relation to ripe fruit availability. Howler monkeys don't need to do this, since they can more leisurely take their time eating leaves, which, as you might imagine, are readily available throughout the rainforest. Rob tells me that for the community of 55 spider monkeys that he studied in Bolivia, he only once saw 53 of them together as they converged on some fruiting trees in a concentrated area.
So what that means is during the day, I would start off following a subgroup. And on average, over the course of the day, that subgroup would change in terms of membership or size 7 or 8 times a day. So that involves complexity. So you're managing a whole bunch of relationships, and you're also those relationships are not, it's not like you're constantly in the group. You're constantly with those animals. You're constantly shifting and changing and managing those relationships.
The social and ecological complexities of spider monkey societies have intrigued Andres enough to spend 2 decades studying them. And this kind of fieldwork is definitely not easy.
The study of spider monkeys is very challenging in the field. It is true that they're large. It is also true that most species, not all, have very unique facial patterns that allow you to identify individuals easier than other species. But they also live in the highest part of the canopy. Also, they move very fast, and given that in many places they have been subject to certain amount of hunting, in most places they can be very skittish. So the challenge of habituating these primates is very big, and most experiences take over a year to get the monkeys really habituated when you really think as a researcher that they are behaving mostly independent of your presence there. And it is very challenging because you can imagine that as soon as they see you, they start moving very fast. And given their large home ranges, that can be very difficult. Something additional is that if you work in places, for example, where there's seasonal flooded forest or places where the monkeys can be safer because researchers cannot follow them, that makes it even more difficult because somehow monkeys know where they are not followed anymore. And thus it takes much longer to get them habituated to your presence.
Despite those challenges, these peculiar primates definitely have a way of capturing the imagination, which I can personally attest to.
I know that you're crazy about spider monkeys, and that's a good thing to be crazy about. I still get a huge kick out of seeing them, you know, even though it's not as frequent as it used to be. I mean, that whole period of my life when I was spending most days with them was really just so joyful. I know that sounds terribly trite, but they really are superb.
This is not an unusual feeling for those who get to know these primates. I connected with them deeply during my time as the Spider Monkey Area Coordinator at the Machia Sanctuary, operated by the Bolivian NGO Comunidad Intihuarayasi. While many other animals currently reside at this sanctuary, most of them victims of trafficking for the pet trade, it was actually meeting a very special spider monkey 20 years ago that propelled the president and co-founder of the organization to devote her life to wildlife rescue and rehabilitation.
Mi nombre es Nena Baltazar Lugones, presidente y cofundadora de la comunidad Intihuarayasi.
The spider monkey that she met all those years ago, by chance, had the same name as she does, Nena, and she was being kept in a small cage in someone's home.
La tenía en una casa, en una jaula pequeñita, la sacaban para jugar, cuando molestaba la ponían en una jaula y bueno, la rescatamos, la rescaté.
They took her out to play, and when she started to cause problems, they would put her back in the cage. We rescued her, I rescued her.
Y como no tenía un lugar donde llevarla, la
And as I didn't have a place to take her, I brought her to my house. In my house, she destroyed everything. So my mother said to me, either the monkey goes or you both go. I grabbed my backpack and left my house. I started walking and looking for a place we could stay with friends.
At the same time, she was starting to study biology and would take Nana to the university with her. But there was no suitable place there for a spider monkey.
No había un lugar, no me iba a las plazas, la dejaba que jueguen los árboles.
I went to city squares. I let her play in the trees, but at one point it became unsustainable. One night I decided to take her to the zoo.
Con muchas lágrimas, tomé la decisión.
With a lot of tears, I made this decision. But the next day, as I wanted to take Nena out of the room inside my sweater as usual, she refused. She grabbed the bed frame with her tail and gave me a look so intense that through that look I could feel that she was asking me not to abandon her in the zoo and to keep fighting for her. In the end, it was that look that won me over, and I said, I don't know what I'm going to do, I don't know where I'm going to go, but I'm not going to leave you, nena.
Y así fue que en 1996 me vine acá al Chapare con una mochila.
And that's how in 1996 I came here to Chapare with my backpack. It was not just Nena anymore. My companions had rescued 3 more monkeys, so it was now 4 monkeys. And we arrived here in Machia, a place we had never been to. We started here in Machia with the municipality. We told them what we wanted to do. They gave us a space, and that's how we began.
No, al principio mi plan era venir y hacer el hogar para Nena y dejarla acá, pero ya estando acá.
At first, my plan was to come, make a home for Nena, and leave her here. But being here, I saw up close the sad reality of many animals that are taken out of the jungle, murdered to be commercialized.
Pues ya el sentimiento de querer ayudar a mi mona, nena, ya se extendió a más otros animalitos. Y así fue que empecé.
So the impulse that I had to help my monkey, nena, extended to more animals. And that's how I started.
When we think of conservation, we tend to think in abstract, philosophical ways about numbers and biodiversity and our role in losing these things, which is incredibly important. But working at the Machia Sanctuary in Bolivia showed me another, more visceral way to understand the significance of what we risk losing. It relates to the way we see non-human animals and the blurry lines that separate us. No longer are they narrowly considered genetically programmed automatons, living out a bland and rote existence devoid of selfhood. As bias favoring the aggrandizement of our own species fades, a careful openness to the complexities of non-human personality grows, finding evidence in everything from the great apes, to birds, to even sharks and beyond. Nowhere has this been more clear to me than with these spider monkeys, whom I have come to know as individuals. Not just curious exemplars of a random endangered species. They each have their quirks and moods and habits and preferences, emotions, and definitely cleverness. Many of the things that make people, people. Perhaps it is the genetic proximity to our fellow primates that makes us more willing or capable of ascribing an inner richness to them. But for me, these monkeys are worth more than just their fascinating biology or ecological roles. When I watch Kishwara try to balance with no hands as she slides down on top of a runner like she's on a magic carpet, or when Sophia hangs upside down on a rope and just spins in circles, both seemingly just for fun, I see a species experiencing the joy of being alive. When Iggy plays gently and tirelessly with any and all of the youngsters, or Michaela hands me a leaf and asks me to clean her imaginary wounds, or I watch Imiita, the little earthquake, dote upon her adoptive mom, who's suffering from a heart condition. I get the feeling that losing this endangered species would be a loss far more tragic than science alone could ever describe. To learn more about Comunidad Intihuarayasi and the work that they do in Bolivia, please visit their website at ciwy.org and also subscribe to this podcast. Our next episode will focus on wildlife trafficking, and it will include much more of our interview with Nena. Special thanks for this episode goes to all of our guests, Andres Link, Robert Wallace, Nena Baltazar Lugones, and Cecilia Coro. It would also not have been possible without the assistance and expertise of Gaspar Reino, who is a wonderful human being despite his worship of false Capuchin idols. And deep gratitude also to Cristina Boronat for lending her voice to the Spanish translation. The music for this episode was by Heavenly Queen, Eaters, Lobo Loco, Dr. Turtle, Bio Unit, Tepocate, and Pottington Bear. All of the monkey sounds were recorded by me, Ben Liebarger, who also produced and edited this podcast. One World Science is an initiative of Field Projects International, which offers field biology training opportunities around the globe. To learn more, visit fieldprojects.org. You can also visit oneworldscience.org or join us on Facebook.
One World One Science. World. 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 One Science.